Yesterday we looked at the source of dependent origination, and we were saying that the source of dependent origination really is the second noble truth. Second noble truth being that craving is the cause of suffering. Yeah, and if you look at the second noble truth, there's three things in there that are kind of the salient features of the second noble truth: the craving, rebirth, and suffering. Yeah, craving, rebirth, and suffering. And those three, if you kind of plug those into dependent origination, you have the framework, the bare bones kind of a framework for dependent origination. Yeah, so based on that, we can then see how possibly, I mean, it's hard to know exactly how the Buddha thought, of course, about this, but we can kind of make a case for how the 12 factor sequence evolved out of those three initial factors. We're starting with the third noble truth. So this is where it starts, with craving, rebirth, and then suffering. You can imagine one of the things that the Buddha would have, when he looked at this, you have the idea that craving is the cause, the condition for rebirth. But it doesn't say what kind of rebirth you have. Yeah, it doesn't say how that, what kind of rebirth will come as a consequence of that craving. And to do that, the Buddha adds two factors. And those two factors are then what kind of gives you an answer to also how the rebirth actually happens. Yeah, so you add grasping and life should be continued existence. Again, there's a bit of small hiccups here on the translation side. So grasping and continued existence teaches you not only the fact that there is rebirth, but what kind of rebirth happens as a consequence of craving. Grasping shows you the kind of kamma that you make is really what this is about. Yeah, the kamma which then leads to existence. So you can see here how this develops out from the basic, the bare bones ideas, kind of comes, the kind of the sequence gradually comes out of that. The next question that the Buddha would have answered is, well, what about craving itself? The problem with craving is that you cannot just stop craving. Yeah, craving doesn't really stop from, you cannot just end it like that. So the question then arises, well, how do you stop craving? What is the cause of craving? And this would have been one of the basic things that the Buddha had insight into during his awakening, yeah, where craving comes from. And craving comes from the idea of ignorance. Yeah, it's because you don't understand reality as it is. You crave for things that you should not crave for. You crave for things that actually are suffering, that are dukkha. Yeah, and that is kind of the root problem of this whole dependent origination sequence. So you can bring the root problem back to ignorance. This would have been a very obvious step for the Buddha to add, because this is kind of what he had insight into on his during his awakening experience. But there is an alternative way of thinking of craving, and that is more the immediate connection to craving, yeah, to understand why craving arises here and now. And this is a very important link, because if we can understand how craving arises right here and now in this life, then we can kind of start by reducing it first of all. Yeah, how do we reduce craving to kind of get enough clarity of mind that ultimately we can have the awakening experience? And that is then the next three factors that he would add in there. Yeah, craving comes from feeling, which is directly related to how we experience the world, the contacting the world. And of course, this is related to the sense fields. Yeah, the six senses. It is through the six senses that we experience the world. So these things are then the kind of the cause or the background through which craving arises. And I'm just giving an outline of this. We're going to go into this in much more detail later on. And then the final question then becomes, well, now that ignorance has been separated from craving in this way, what is the connection from ignorance to the six sense fields? Yeah. And what the Buddha is doing here, he also adds another dimension to the idea of dependent origination. And this is similar to what the gentleman over here was talking about before. And this is the idea of how consciousness itself is conditioned. Yeah, the idea that consciousness is not a stand-alone entity, but depends on other factors. So that's what the Buddha then adds in the last three factors of dependent origination, which is the choices, consciousness, and nama, name and form. So in a sense, it's quite, once you kind of pare dependent origination down to the bare bones, craving, rebirth and suffering, you can kind of see how that naturally then unfolds and becomes the 12 links as a consequence. It's almost like an organically kind of forms out. And of course, this could be expanded much further. Yeah, you could keep on expanding this in all kinds of interesting ways. You could add things about the perceptual process in human beings. You can add heaps. You can make this as long as you possibly wanted. But this is where the Buddha kind of basically ended his teaching to make it manageable, I suppose. But you could presumably have almost an infinite number of factors in here if you wanted to.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are places where they are added, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, so that's just to give you an idea of the expansion of dependent origination from the basics. End. Means we can go back here.
End?
Yeah, finished.
What?
No more.
We finished when we've dependently ceased.
We've dependently ceased, yeah.
We have dependently ceased. So, These slideshows that Venerable Brahmali's putting together were organised originally for the sessions given in Perth, and so they're not going to, because they were given like once a week for a whole day thing, so it's a bit organised a bit differently than how we're doing it today. We were supposed to do up to there yesterday. Right, no, no, that didn't work. Well, we weren't, yes we were. But we weren't.
I said we weren't.
Okay.
That's what I said anyway.
We either were or we weren't.
But maybe both, is that right?
We both were and were not supposed to finish this, but yes.
Something like that, anyway.
We certainly were not supposed to babble meaninglessly instead of actually teaching dependent origination. So anyway, the upshot of this is that we have another slideshow, right? We have another slideshow. So we're going to start with the next session. Already.
Okay, your turn to talk.
You're talked out. Give me a slide.
Yeah. We're going to talk about ignorance.
So what are we doing now? Are we actually going through the factors in detail, or what are we doing?
We're going to discuss avijja first of all. Yeah. We need to discuss avijja so people have an understanding of avijja.
Okay.
So you can just go through the factors if you like, and you can just help yourself.
To the factor.
The beginning of ignorance.
The beginning of ignorance.
Okay. Very good.
So now we're going to begin with the more detailed look at each of the individual factors of dependent origination, beginning with avijja, or ignorance. So let's begin by looking into our own minds. Right now, what do you know? We can see something, right? If you're sitting there, if your faculty of sight is working, you can see, and you know what you see. You can look around the room and you can see these things and you can know, oh, I see these people, I can see this slideshow. We know what we're touching. Okay. You can touch something, we can know that. And these are things that we can know pretty well. And in fact, the human senses are incredibly refined. We can hear very, very slight sounds. We can see, if our eyes are fully adjusted to the light, we can see even just a few photons. You can touch things that are so very subtle, like a fraction of a millimeter, and you can touch and you can feel that difference on things. And so our senses are attuned very finely to knowing things. What about in our minds? What do we know? Well, we can know, do I feel tired or awake? Do I feel in a good mood or a bad mood? We can know these things. There are other things that we can know. Do we know that this is a hotel? That's a different kind of knowing, isn't it? Because it's kind of conceptual. You can't see that, but you have a concept about it. Do we know that... do you know what your name is? Well, we think we know what our name is, but I mean, sometimes people forget that, don't they? And so this idea of knowing, what we can know, is quite complex. And there's a lot of shades between what we know, what we think we know, what we would like to think that we know. And the tendency of our mind is to seek out knowing. We like to know. Yeah? If you're in your home alone at night and you hear a bump and it's dark, you're like, what's that? And you're afraid because you don't know. And if you know, oh, it's just the neighbor's cat, ah, okay, now I feel good. Or if you're doing a crossword puzzle and you get to an answer, you don't know the answer. And you feel frustrated. There's a tension. This is what drives us, why we like to do these things. And you get the answer. Ah, knowing arises. So knowing feels good because our minds are knowing machines. That's the point of a mind, is to know things. We've evolved and we've developed to know and to want to know. And so knowing, if you like, is the surface of reality and of our experience. It's the thing that we see, the thing that we pay attention to. And then there's all the things that we don't see, all the things that are behind the curtain, things of which we are unconscious, things that are unknown. And those things that are unknown are strange and disturbing. And we fill that unknown with our imagination, and we fill it with our fears and our hopes. And we'd like to imagine that the world that we see, the world that is known, is the world. And as we get older and we get wiser, we start to realize something's going on here that's not quite right. Think about, for example, the classical story of Siddhartha, when he, according to the legends of the Buddha, when Siddhartha was kept at home and his father would hide the true nature of the world from him. And he never saw an old person, never saw a sick person, never saw a dead person. And when he went out from the palace, then he could, for the first time, see a sick person, first time see an old person, first time see a dead person. And so he's catching a glimpse of what lies behind the curtain. Starting to realize that this world is broader and stranger and deeper and more disturbing than anything that he'd imagined. And this is when we're starting to understand this kind of idea of avidya. This idea that we live and yet we do not know. We make choices. Why? Why do we do these things? Why do we live the way that we live? Why do we get up every morning? Why do we do our job? Why are we married to this person? What is my life about? Why am I here? And we realize that actually at a fundamentally deep level, we don't really know the answers to a lot of these questions. We just do, that's all. Why do we like this and we don't like that? Why do I like coffee and I don't like tea? Well, I don't mind tea, it's all right. Why do I drink coffee? I don't know. It's just I do. Why did I become a monk? People ask me these questions, like, why did you become a monk? I don't know. Why didn't you? And so many, like the choices and things, like, why did you wear that shirt today? Why do we do the things that we do? And so many of the things we do, we don't actually really know what we're doing. And so, because we don't know, we don't understand, and yet our minds are seeking knowledge. And yet, so we end up becoming satisfied with a facsimile of knowledge, with a kind of a shallow knowledge which is good enough for us to get by. And just enough knowledge for us to get by. And for most people, that's okay. Most people go your whole life and you don't necessarily need to answer these questions, or you just give up, or you say, oh, nobody really knows, or I'll have another beer and that'll answer the question for me. And that's kind of good enough. But of course, for the Buddha, that wasn't good enough. And he really wanted to go and try to answer this question. And one of the terms that he uses for this, specifically the Buddhist term, is yoniso manasikara. And yoniso manasikara means investigation that looks into causes, goes back to the source of things. And why? Why is the world like this? Why is there aging and death? What's going on? Why is it that everybody seems to live their life without knowing why they're doing it? Why is it that everybody looks for happiness and yet they're constantly falling into suffering? Why? Why is it that we want to live and yet we die? Why is it that we want to stay young and we get old? Why is it that we want to be healthy and yet we fall sick? Why? What's going on? And it's this relentless, restless curiosity that drove the Bodhisattva's search, that he described as the Arya Pariyesana, the noble quest. What is the source of aging and death and rebirth? Where do these things come from? And this is this fundamental question that drove him in his quest. This is why he left the home. It's why he went into the forest and practiced for 6 years. It's why he rejected all of his former teachers. None of them could answer this question. Why do we do all these things? What is the point of it? What is going on? And so this drive is this kind of existential question. And at its root, dependent origination is an existential teaching. What that means is that its primary purpose, not its only purpose, its primary purpose is not to tell us how to live. A teaching that tells us how to live is a moral teaching. And of course, within Buddhism, there are many moral teachings, and that's part of the answer to this question. But dependent origination itself is not teaching us how to live so much. Its main emphasis is on what is going on. What is this life? Where has it come from? And if we follow these questions far enough, we reach this blank slate where we just have to say that we don't know. Why do you suffer? I don't know. Why do we cause suffering to others? Actually, we just want everybody to be happy. And yet in our lives, we bring suffering to other people and other creatures. Why? Why do we do that? We don't know. Why is our life caught up in all of these things? We don't know. What's suffering? Where does it come from? How does it end? How do you get out of it? We don't know these things. And at the fundamental level, this is the avidya, or the ignorance that the Buddha was talking about. And so because we don't know, we don't understand, then this is what begins the whole thing. This is the most fundamental level, the fundamental cause of this whole process of what we call life, samsara, rebirth, whatever we want to call it. We don't know. And if we step back from the suttas for a moment and step back from what the texts are saying for a moment, that unknowing is an ever-present reality for each of us. Each of you is sitting there not knowing. Think about how your mind works. Minds are very odd. Minds are very strange because we, like, everything that we've ever known happens in our mind. Everything we thought, everything we've seen, all our memories, everything is just the workings of our mind. And everything is just that experience. And yet, minds are really weird. Like, why do you think this and you don't think that? Where does this memory come from? Why am I feeling like this today? Let me give you a test on how your mind works. Let me ask you a question. What's 2 + 2? Who can tell me? It's not a trick question. Go on. 4. Thank you. Very good. Where did the number 4 came from when I asked that question? Sorry? Can you speak up a bit, please? Roman numerals, okay, but in your mind, I'm not talking historically, in your mind, where did they come from, the number 4?
Memory.
Memory? Okay. What's 730 plus 4? 734, right? Now, probably you've never had that exact sum before, right? Where did that come from? It didn't come from your memory. Sorry?
Mental training.
You're all giving me words to talk about it. But the reality is, in your experience, it wasn't there, and then it was. Yeah?
Experience.
Experience? Okay, again, but these are just words. In your mind, when I say these words, all we can say is it's not there, and then it is.
So that point, that's what you're talking about, the point between when, like, it wasn't there.
Yeah.
You asked the question,
yeah.
Then it was.
Then it was.
So the point between when it wasn't and when it was.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Sure, conditions, I mean, these, none of these are wrong answers, right? But my point is that I'm not asking for that kind of answer. I'm asking for you to look into your experience and to see where do things come up in your mind. And the fact is that it's mysterious. We don't really, it's just there. It's weird. And, you know, you can rationalize and understand it to a certain extent, but there's a lot of things that's going on in your mind where we really just don't understand it. Now, I mean, psychologists know about this. They call it the unconscious and explain it and discuss it in various kinds of ways. But the Buddha, all of those years ago, was talking about avidya, unknowing. And so even though we think of ourselves as knowing beings, I mean, it's even the name of the species that we give ourselves, Homo sapiens. Yeah? We're the intelligent ones, yay us, right? And look, and fair enough, we are intelligent. But there's still, what?
Well,
Yeah. Well, I mean, relatively speaking, compared to a goldfish or something.
Okay.
Yeah, compared to a goldfish, we're not too bad. Yeah. Okay. On average. No hate on goldfish. Okay, so so we identify as these kind of knowing, that we believe that we're knowing, we believe that we're operating in this world and we know what we're doing. But in fact, at a fundamental level, we don't. We're just reacting to things. And why do we want? Why do we crave? Why do we get attached to it? Why do we get so angry about something? Why does this thing matter to us and it doesn't matter to someone else? All of these things, they come up. And so many times we just don't know. And so we act and we create choices fundamentally from this ignorance. Now, when the Buddha talked about ignorance, he defined it. He said it's not knowing suffering, not knowing the origin of suffering, not knowing the ending of suffering, not knowing the path to the ending of suffering. So it's defined in terms of the Four Noble Truths. So when we talked about it, when Romali gave his presentation, we talked about it. We talked about how within the Four Noble Truths that dependent origination can be understood as an explanation of the second and third noble truths. So the second noble truth is the arising of suffering. The third noble truth is the ending of suffering. And dependent origination is a detailed explanation of these two points. But also, so dependent origination is included in the Four Noble Truths. But the Four Noble Truths are also included in dependent origination. Yeah. So the Buddha was a master at this kind of mind melding kind of stuff. The point being that all of these are different ways of seeing the same truth and the same reality. So ignorance, in its fundamental level, is not seeing why we suffer, why we cause the suffering, how do we end it, what do we do to end this suffering. Not seeing these things. And with the arising of knowledge, which comes through insight, then we can begin to see the ending of all of these things. What is that knowledge and what is that insight that leads to the ending of those things? Obviously, the Buddha talked about that knowledge and that insight in many different kinds of ways. But one framework for understanding knowledge and insight that I personally like is a framework that's spelled out. I can't remember where it's first spelled out, but it's spelled out in the commentaries and somewhere, but it's drawn from the suttas. But there are basically three stages or three different aspects to that knowledge. So the first aspect is knowing and scrutinizing and examining things. And in a way, that's what we're doing here. We're building up the bedrock of knowledge by looking at individual things, looking at ideas and concepts, trying to clarify the concepts and understanding in our mind. Yeah. The second way we can build knowledge is through applying it to inference. We can understand the connections between things. And so this is what happens when you start to apply it, especially in your meditation, and you start to see, the Buddha talked about impermanence, but then you actually start to see through impermanence in your own mind. And you begin to realize that how this attachment works, and that light of vidya, of knowledge, is starting to spread and the darkness is starting to contract. Yeah. And the final aspect of knowledge is giving up. Letting go. And when there's full, real understanding means letting go. What that means is that in Buddhism, truth is ultimately a functional concept. And in that way, truth in Buddhism is very similar to truth in science. Because truth in science is always pragmatic. It's always approximate. It's always statistical at some level. If you want to measure how fast something is going, you can only ever measure it approximately. And so there's always some kind of rounding that you have to do. When they made this building, an engineer came along and they said, okay, we're going to have to build these walls this thick, we're going to have to make these pillars with a certain kind of strength, we're going to have to design the floors with a certain kind of thickness and so on, so that all doesn't fall down. Thank you, engineers, for working this stuff out. And they all have formulas for all doing all of these things. But none of those formulas are exact. They don't know exactly the particular load-bearing strength of that pillar over there. They kind of know it within a certain margin, and then they allow a bit extra for safety. But the point is not, does the engineer know all of these things exactly? The point is, does the engineer know these things well enough so that the building doesn't fall down? That's what matters. That's the only thing that matters. Yeah? Does the building fall down? It's the same thing in Buddhism. This is why, you know, it's not that we have to know everything. It's not that we have to, we all have to have the same level of wisdom or insight or understanding or all of these kinds of things. What matters is that we can let go. Even within the great disciples of the Buddha, you know, you had Sariputta who had stronger wisdom than others. And there's a difference in that. But they all had that wisdom that would lead to letting go. So if we can let go, that is the wisdom, the vidya, that matters. Ultimately, everything else is steps towards that. But the wisdom that matters, do we let go of causing suffering, creating suffering for ourselves and for others? Yeah, good question. So the question was that if we have full vidya and full knowledge, then that's it. We're not going to get reborn, and we're just going to go, like the Buddha said, we're going to be snuffed out like a flame. Why? Why would you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want to stay here and be happy and help lots of people? Yeah? Seems like a very reasonable question. I'll give that to Venerable Brahmali.
Shall we have a bit of meditation first? It's already 6:30. Yeah. I think. Okay. So the. I don't know. Yeah. Okay.
Gives me a bit of side eye. Yeah.
So why don't we just hang around and help people when we become enlightened? The point of Buddhism is to, as you just said, is kind of to attain happiness. Yeah, and this is. Obviously, this happens through eradicating ignorance. And then when you eradicate ignorance, you go through all of these 12 steps and then eradicate suffering at the very end. But the point is, and this is kind of why what is so so hard to grasp with the Buddha's teaching, is that rebirth is precisely the process of suffering. Yeah, that is what suffering is about, is being reborn. And the only way you're going to end suffering is by not being reborn. Yeah, that's kind of the idea here. And what exactly that implies, not to be reborn, well, this is in one sense, it is very hard to understand. And the reason why it is hard to understand is because of ignorance. Yeah, so because we have ignorance is, the way Adan Sujato presented a very beautiful discourse by Adan Sujato, but, a very important part of ignorance is the idea of delusion. Yeah, and delusion means that we are not able to see things as they actually are. So if I say to you that, ending rebirth is a good idea, it's impossible to really understand that. It's impossible because the delusion blinds you from being able to understand what actually is obvious if you saw it. And this has to do with the delusion of a sense of self. The sense of self gets in the way. That's why you can't see it. So for that reason, sometimes it is not very useful to think of the end of the path as the end of rebirth, because you cannot really understand what that means. It's much better to think of it as the end of suffering, because that is something we can relate to, at least partially, at least in part. So I would normally recommend to people don't worry too much about what it means to end existence. Yeah, don't worry too much about it. Focus instead on the idea of ending suffering, because that is something you can relate to. But let me give you, anyway, some idea of what it means to end existence, yeah? It's kind of nice to have some kind of framework for which how to think about this. If you think about this intellectually, it may sound like a really, really bad idea. Yeah, it sounds terrible. Think of it instead experientially. Yeah, so when we meditate, which we're going to do in 2 minutes' time because we need a bit of a break here, but so when you meditate, notice that when you exist less, and by existing less, I mean having less thinking, yeah, less things going on inside of you, the more things calm down, the less you are present, the more empty you feel inside, the better you feel. Yeah, the less existence there is, the more happy you are, basically, in the present moment. And that is a way of getting a handle on the idea why ending of things actually is a very high degree of happiness. Yeah, and you will notice sometimes you get incredibly peaceful. It's as if you are no longer there almost. All there is just happiness and peace. That is when you are the most happy. Get yourself out of the way, you are more happy. Yeah, and this is an idea of how to kind of grasp from a more experiential idea why ending, why you know, extinguishment in a sense, ending of rebirth, why that is a positive thing. Because if you think about it intellectually, it sounds scary here. If you go from experience, actually you can understand why it is a beautiful thing here. I don't know. So now let us go on to the next slide. This is a Calvin and Hobbes slide. I don't know if this is copyrighted or what, but anyway, this is one. So here you have Calvin saying to Hobbes, "I don't want to go to school. I don't want to know anything new. I already know more than I want to. I like things better when I didn't understand them." "The fact is, I'm being educated against my will. My rights are being trampled." And then Hobbes say, "Is it a right to remain ignorant? I don't know, but I refuse to find out." This is kind of ignorance. This is kind of what we're trying to avoid, that refusal to find out. Is that right?
I mean, Calvin and Hobbes both being philosophers.
Right, of course. Yeah. So that's kind of bad for philosophers, isn't it? Well, Calvin, I guess, is the dodgy one here.
I mean, realistically, if we actually sorted stuff out, philosophers would be out of a job.
Yeah, so that's bad for them to find out. They're supposed to be ignorant. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Well, you can publish more papers that way.
Yeah. I see. Right, okay, so it's good for philosophers to remain ignorant. Okay, good. That's an interesting take on that. So let's see what it has next one. Ignorance, delusion, avidya. So we have already talked about this in quite a bit of detail. So let's just summarize a few of the ways in which this is expressed in the suttas. Yeah, one of the important ways that ignorance is expressed, avidya, in the suttas is the threefold knowledge. Yeah, this is in response to the Brahmanical ideas of knowledge in ancient India. The Brahmanism, or the Brahmanical teachings, are the precursors to modern-day Hinduism, by the way, just for you, so you are aware of that. And they had an idea of the threefold knowledge. Yeah, and the threefold knowledge at that time was the ancient scriptures of the Brahmins, which was the threefold knowledge. And then the Buddha, what he often did, he would take the concepts that existed in India at the time, Brahmanical ideas, and he would rephrase them and reframe them in a new light in accordance with his own teachings. So he would take the idea of the Te Vidya means three knowledges, according to ancient Brahmanism, and he would give them a new content. And instead of referring to scriptures, and the scriptures would be the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, and the Sama Veda, the three earliest scriptures of the Brahmins, he then made them into insights instead. And one of the things what is nice about Vidya here is actually translated as insight. Yeah. So what you then have, instead of thinking of these things as knowledge, is to think of them as insights into reality. Yeah? So very often when we talk about insight meditation, we talk about watching feelings arise in the body and feeling passing away and this kind of thing. And sometimes there may be a little bit of insight there, but often it's just watching stuff, not you wonder what the insight is. But if you want to talk about real insights, this is the kind of thing that we're talking about. Yeah, because here we're talking about a real change in our attitude to reality. We kind of see reality in an entirely new way. And so these are the three things that come at the very end of the Buddhist path: seeing rebirth, seeing kamma. Yeah, kamma just means seeing how rebirth happens, and then the final thing is then the awakening experience itself. These are kind of the real core insights of the Buddhist teachings. Now, what is interesting about these insights is that they correspond very closely to the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, and this is kind of something which is kind of helpful to understand what these three insights are about. So let's just have a look at the correspondence. So here we have the Four Noble Truths, yeah? Suffering, the origin, the ending, and the path. This is how it is very often described in short in the suttas, the kind of dukkha, samudaya, nirodha, and magga is how it is often described in the suttas, the four things. And there's many ways in which you can look at these things. For example, the idea of suffering can be understood in many different ways, and we will look at this later on. But there's an interesting connection between these two sets, yeah, which is this connection here. So the idea of rebirth is then the idea of suffering. Yeah. Kamma, yeah, which explains how rebirth comes about, is then really equivalent to the origin of suffering. Yeah. And the awakening experience is the equivalent to the ending of suffering. Yeah. So when you think about the Te Vidyas, you read about them in the suttas, then actually they are directly linked to the Four Noble Truths in this particular way. Yeah. Which is kind of interesting, yeah, because it gives you a different framework through which to understand these particular things. And then you have the path, and the path kind of comes in addition, but it's sort of implied in the idea of awakening, because you can only awaken through a particular path. So this is one way of thinking about the idea of ignorance or knowledge, yeah, the kind of two sides of the same coin here. There is another way, many different ways of thinking about this, and there's one other way I want to talk about, because this is the way I want to use to relate avidya to sankhara, avidya paccaya sankhara. The ignorance is the condition, yeah, is the sufficient condition for choices, for willed activities. So what is a good way of thinking about ignorance so we can make sense of this connection between these two, the connection between avidya and sankhara? We want to explore this connection, yeah? What does this mean? How can we look at this? And to enable us to do that, we want to look at avidya through a particular lens. And this is the lens I want to use. Yeah, this is the lens of the three characteristics, which many of you will know about. This is called the Tilakana in Pali. Yeah, there was someone who asked for more Pali words here yesterday. Yeah, so there you are. Okay, so more Pali words. Yeah, Tilakana, the three characteristics, the three kind of lenses through which to look at existence or life or the five khandhas and this kind of thing. What are those three characteristics? Impermanence, suffering, and non-self. Yeah. So these are called like the marks of existence. Yeah, if you look at any phenomenon in the world, any phenomenon can be regarded through these characteristics, and that is why they are so important. This is kind of the ground of insight. This is where insight happens. It happens through the understanding of these particular characteristics. And the idea of impermanence, what does that mean? Well, it means that things are always changing. Yeah, things are never stable. But not only are they changing, they also come to an end. Yeah, they are impermanent in a very particular way, in the sense that they actually end, they completely stop. And sometimes you will see translations of impermanence like rise and fall. Yeah, that's sometimes a translation you have seen in the suttas. But to my mind, it is not the ideal translation, because rise and fall can imply something that is there, that comes and like the ocean is always there. It rises with the tide and it falls when the tide goes out. But that is not the idea of impermanence. The idea of impermanence is something which comes out of nothing and disappears into nothing. Yeah? So it's a very specific kind of impermanence. It's an impermanence which is very profound. And not only is it the fact that things are impermanent in this very profound way, they are also out of control. It is not something you can control. Yeah, so it is impermanent and it is unreliable. Yeah, it is out of control. So it's another way of thinking about impermanence as unreliable. And in a sense, that is a nice way of thinking about impermanence, because unreliable is like something which is more emotional. Yeah, if a person is unreliable, you think, what, unreliable person? Yeah, we don't like unreliable people because we can't rely on them. That's why we don't like them. But impermanent people, this kind of bit doesn't really kind of have that same idea. Yeah, you are unreliable.
I don't take it personally.
You don't take it personally. Okay, I shall not comment on that any further. I think I'll leave that one to hang in the air. So. So this is the first characteristics, yeah, the idea of unreliability, impermanence, cessation, all of that. And we shall see how this affects sankharas later on, why this relates to the next factor, which is willed activities. Then there is the idea of suffering, and this often arises out of the fact that things are unreliable and impermanent. Things in the world are, first of all, they are less satisfactory than they seem, but secondly, because they are unreliable, it means we can't rely on them. If they're unreliable, obviously we can't rely on them, and that is problematic because we tend to hold on to things in the world. If you hold on to stuff that is impermanent, you know the result. Suffering, right? This is the problem. This is why attachment in the world is so problematic, because attachment up against the reality of impermanence. This is precisely why attachment is problematic. I know some of people say, but attachment is good. A baby needs to be attached to his mother. Yes, there is a psychological sense in which attachment is good. But the point here is just that if you try to hold on to things in the world which are impermanent, it's going to be problematic. This is why we suffer when people die. This is why we suffer when we lose our job. This is why we suffer when this course is over. I'm being naughty now. So that's the idea of suffering. And the final of these characteristics is the idea of non-self. And this is some of the questions we just had here before. We're talking about the Atman. And the Atman is precisely the anti-teaching to the idea of Atman. It's un-Atman. Un-Atman, the opposite of Atman. So this is a teaching that the Buddha specifically brought out to counter the ancient Indian ideas of a self, which existed in India prior to the Buddha. And then he says, actually, you got it wrong. Sorry, everyone, you got it wrong. This is the right way of looking at reality, non-self. The idea here is that, again, it feels like we are in charge. It feels like we are in control of things. It feels like we have some kind of essence, which is the real us. But the reality is that we are far less in control than it feels like. This idea of feeling in control is largely a delusion. Once you understand that, once you understand that the idea of being in charge is an illusion, then the whole idea of craving doesn't make any sense anymore. There's a very close connection between the idea of controlling a self and the idea of craving. The reason we crave, to a large part, is because it expresses our sense of self when we try to fulfill our cravings. We express ourselves in this way by running after the things that we crave for. We express ourselves in this way because we identify with this doing aspect of things. But when we see that that thing is actually empty, that there is nothing really there that has the capacity to fulfill things in the world, that is a complete misunderstanding. That craving actually is a problem. That is the calming down of craving, which leads to real peace or whatever. Then the whole idea of a sense of self falls through. That is only the initial idea. And then at a more fundamental level, the whole idea turns out to be empty, even in a more kind of sense of knowing and awareness of existence. And the idea of non-self is then what you realize in regard to all phenomena of the world. And when you see that, it has a very profound effect on your choices and on your willed activities. And this is what we're going to look at shortly. So those are the three characteristics. Very, very important in Buddhism. This is what we are trying to get insight into on the Buddhist path. When we talk about insight, this is really what we are looking at. So this is what mindfulness of breathing, ultimately is all about, is seeing these three characteristics. Bhante, your turn. You want to say something about this?
No, I think that's fine. I'm good. I'm good to
go into that one. You're good. Okay. So, what happens next here? Oh, more cartoon. That's good. That's good news. Is that right? Speak.
When you visit Bodhinyana Monastery.
Oh, these are trade secrets. Please, don't trade secrets.
You will see the beautiful Dhamma Hall with the lovely Buddha image, and you will see the monks lining up for the meal, dana, and you will see all of the. What you probably won't see is the cupboard in the library that says monks only. And your ignorance will make you wonder what secrets are held within. What is it that the monks regard as so special, so sacred, that they must be kept hidden from the world? And were you to be bold enough to open that cupboard, you would find quite a lot of Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah, this is Ajahn Brahm's kind of idea of, you know, life is supposed to be fun, yeah? So he says that when you are on retreat, you're feeling a bit kind of down or whatever, and then get a Calvin Hobbes book, and then you're kind of back in business again. Yeah? That's how Bodhidharma Monastery works.
But also, the cupboard has a skeleton and all the asuga material.
But that used to be on the shelves. The Calvin Hobbes has always been in the back room, yeah? That's the difference.
There is a literal skeleton in the cupboard.
Yeah, we have these things called Asubha pictures. They're very common in Buddhist monasteries. These are kind of pictures of corpses and all kind of stuff, which is kind of not very nice. And we used to have it on the shelves in the library. And one day, some local people came into our library. I don't know how they got into our library, but they got in there and started flicking through the books. And after that, we packed them away in the cupboard somewhere, because they wonder what you're all about. Yeah, when you have kind of pictures of corpses, it's always a bad idea on the shelves. Anyway, so this is the cartoon, yeah? And so this is it. So Hobbes says to Calvin, aren't you supposed to be doing your homework? Yeah. And Calvin says, I'm pretty sure the assignment was optional. Hobbes says, denial springs eternal. And then it says, it's not denial, I'm just very selective about the reality I accept. And so this is a kind of quite nice, actually. Anyway, so there you are. What comes next? Okay, why is there avijja? Yeah. So how are we doing for time, by the way? Do we have?
We're doing okay. Yeah.
Are you sure? Are you under control?
It's 7 o'clock.
Is it on the 7 o'clock? Gee, yeah. That's marvelous. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. So this is, one of the purposes of dependent origination, as we said before, the idea of understanding causality and conditionality, yoniso manasikara, which is a beautiful term we find in the suttas, which means, manasikara means attention, and yoniso means like the root of things, yeah, where things come from, so attention that goes to the source of things. And in Buddhism, this is a very important idea, precisely because things are, if things are non-self, it means that everything is conditioned. So there's always a reason for why things are there. Yeah? So we can always investigate sources and causes for why things are in a certain way. Yeah? So for that reason, it's also good to ask, why is there avijja? Why is there this ignorance? And if we can understand the idea of ignorance, then of course we can start to do something about it, yeah? Which is of course the whole point of this. And fortunately, you might think this is going to go back eternally because you can always find another cause. But there are certain causes that are more salient and important than other ones. They are more significant to help us to unravel this whole problem of ignorance and delusion. So this is why. This is a sutta is called the Avijja Sutta. You see the AN up there means the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourse of the Buddha. 10 is the chapter 10. It's the chapter with 10 items, sutta number 61. Lots of suttas in there. They're really cool suttas, so I'm going to talk about some of these cool suttas. So, why is there avijja? And then comes this famous saying that we had a look at very briefly before. First point of ignorance, which is avijja, mendicant. So this is Bhantasudrato's translation. If you see the word mendicant, you know straight away, Bhantasudrato. He, as I like to say, he is the only person in the known universe who translates bhikkhu as mendicant.
No, that's not true at all.
Isn't it?
No, there's lots of people who use mendicant.
From the old days.
Lots of people. Cool translators do mendicants.
Who are these cool translators?
There's too many to mention right now.
Is that true?
No, but there are.
Really? Yeah, okay. So there you are. So I was wrong about that. Okay. What about immersion? Is that how many people use immersion?
That's me.
That's you. Okay. Yeah, so that's the known universe one. Thank you. Okay. So immersion, that's what I should have said. Okay. Not mendicants. Okay, we'll come to that later on. So when I get a chance, I will criticize that translation. Anyway. Okay, so the first point of ignorance, mending, is not seen such that before this there was no ignorance and afterwards it came into being. Yeah, so this is already very interesting. This is what we were discussing before, the idea of the beginning of life and where life ends. Ignorance obviously implies life, it implies beings. So basically what this is saying, there's no first point of rebirth, there is no first point of existence, it just goes back. And so what it also implies is this idea that ignorance is self-perpetuating. Once you have ignorance, then ignorance tends to perpetuate itself. It goes from one life to the next one. Blindness leads to blindness. Yeah, and this is very interesting, because what that means is that it's actually very hard to find our way out. Because blindness leads to blindness. How do you find your way out of something that is kind of where you are trapped in a sense? And this is one of the reasons why in Buddhism we talk about the significance of the Buddha, because the Buddha is that very rare individual who was able to find his way out of the darkness. He becomes the eye of the world. Yeah, there's one of the names for the Buddha, the eye of the world. He says, this is what I have discovered. Listen, yeah, and you will be able to see the same thing. So he kind of opens up the possibility of seeing things in a new way. He breaks through this idea of ignorance, which otherwise is almost impossible to break through because it is self-perpetuating. Anyway, so it goes back. This is kind of the first point. Yeah, but that is not all. Even though it is self-perpetuating, this is still true. Yeah, still ignorance is seen to have a specific condition. We saw this idea of specific condition before, idapachyata, the idea that there is a specific thing that tends to support ignorance. What is that thing? Any ideas? Here we go. Oops, what happened? Gee. I said that ignorance has a nutriment. Okay, oh, this is just the... Okay, so this is the same thing, yeah? So it has specific condition, has a nutriment, same thing. This is the answer, the five hindrances. Yeah?
What's the number
we're
on,
by? 1061. Yeah. So this is very interesting, right? Because the five hindrances are a core aspect of what we call our meditation terminology. Yeah, these are the things that we try to overcome in meditation practice. So you will know these things straight away when you see the five hindrances. This is the support for ignorance, yeah, support for avidya. So the idea here is that as long as there is the five hindrances in the mind, avidya is supported, avidya is stuck in a sense because of those five hindrances. The stronger the five hindrances are, the stronger the delusion is going to be. Yeah, we are deluded, literally deluded by these very things. When you have a desire for the objects of the sensory world, well, that desire is like a distortion of reality. Vested interest in things that when you stand back and you look at them more neutrally, actually are not worthy of the interest that you give them. So it is a distortion implied in the very idea of desiring the things of the world. You cannot see things clearly, see them neutrally, and have desire for them at the same time, because the desire has a distorting effect on things. And that's why you have to withdraw from the desire, especially for the objects of the five senses. And when you withdraw from them, that is when you have a chance to see things clearly. So the idea here, this is why the elimination of the five hindrances is so important. Yeah, this is why it matters so enormously. Yeah? And that this is why we want to eliminate them, not just temporarily, but in a profound way through samadhi practice or whatever it is, so that they are really down and out for a long period of time to enable us to gain insight into reality so we can overturn this avidya. So when the five hindrances are gone, it means that avidya has no nutriment, it has no support. Nutriment is something which supports things or gives it an additional growth or whatever it is. Take away the five hindrances, the support is gone. And when the support is gone, it is weak. Avidya is very weak at that particular point. So you eliminate the five hindrances, then you use the power of the mind to investigate the factors of existence, the five khandhas or whatever, the aspects of personality, because avidya, because the five hindrances are gone, avidya is weak. At that point, it is easy, relatively easy, to overturn that avidya and then gain insight into reality. So this is the promise. Yeah, it doesn't sound as bad. This sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah, we know about the five hindrances. We know about this kind of terminology in meditation. So if you can deal with that, then we are kind of on the right track. Yeah? So this is the cause, yeah, or the condition, the specific condition for avidya. So it's kind of good news. So let's see what happens next. So this just gives you an idea of this particular sutta gives you a series of causes, conditions going back. So what then is the condition for the five hindrances? The answer is the three kinds of misconduct. Misconduct by body, speech, and mind. Yeah, there's the three kinds of misconduct. Body, speech, and mind. Yeah, it's again quite nice. We all know about these three kinds of misconduct. This is about morality, ethics, about living well, living with kindness, and all of these kind of things. So it's kind of, yeah, you can start to see how this path really is becomes possible, yeah, once you start to understand the causality here. Then I have skipped a large number of steps. So here we have the idea of careless attention being one of the steps in the sequence. This being ayoniso manasikara, the opposite of yoniso manasikara, unwise attention or careless attention. Where does that come from? Lack of faith, a lack of confidence in the Buddha's teachings. If you have confidence in the Buddha's teachings, then you have an ability to attend carefully to things because you attend in the way the Buddha says we should attend. Yeah, you learn to attend in the right way. You learn if you look at people in this way, you will get angry. So don't look at people like this. Look at people, see their good qualities, have compassion for them. Then you will not get angry with people. Yes, this is how the Buddha teaches you careful attention, if you like. And then eventually, if you practice that careful attention properly, it will lead to the three kinds of good conduct. You can see how this works, probably. Lack of faith, yeah? And the lack of faith comes from not hearing the good Dhamma. Yeah? Why don't we hear the good Dhamma? It is for this reason, huh? Not associating with good persons. So this is the root thing of this entire thing, yeah? Not associating with good people. This is the root problem, and this is why we're not kind of making an end of avidya. And so what does that mean, not to associate with good people? So let's just start, let's do the opposite sequence, yeah? What does it mean to associate with good persons, just to see the positive instead? What does that mean? And what it means, it means to basically associate with those people who have an understanding of the Dhamma. Yeah, those people who have an insight into those teachings. Who are those people? I don't know. This is a hard question, right? Who is it that has insight into these teachings? Like a real insight? What did someone say? Calvin and Hobbes? No. Sometimes, yeah. Saporisas, yeah, that's good. Huh? Sometimes Sangha, yeah. What about the Upasakas and Upasikas? Do they have insight into that? Yeah, sometimes, yeah. So the preeminent good person is the Buddha himself. Yeah, and one of the difficulties of the Buddhist path is that sometimes we don't really know who to trust. Yeah, I'm sure many of you will know, you listen to one monk and they say anicca means non-desire. We say it means impermanence. So who is right, non-desire or the one who says impermanence? Well, if I tell you, it's just my biased view, right? So you can't really go on that basis. So the answer is, well, ultimately, the way to decide anything in Buddhism is to go back to the word of the Buddha and then to appreciate that as the foundation of everything here. Yeah, this is why the Buddha is the ultimate good person and who we use to associate with. How do you associate with the Buddha now? You read the suttas. Does that sound strange to associate with the Buddha by reading the suttas? And I will... The thing is that it's not as strange as you might think. Because one of the remarkable things about the Buddha is that when the Buddha taught these teachings, 2,500 years ago, he said in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana. this is the first sutta of the Buddha, Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which means the setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. So when the Buddha started his teaching career 2,500 years ago, he was aware that this wheel of the Dhamma would roll on into the world for a long, long time into the future. Going from one generation to the next one, from one country to the next one, from one culture to the next one. He was aware of what he was doing here. Yeah. And because of that, he phrased the teachings of Buddhism in such a way that they would be universally applicable. Yeah, because he knew what he was doing. He wasn't, most religions, if you read something like the Bible or whatever, you realize it is a teaching given to a specific people at a specific time. It is not a universal religion or a universal teaching in the same way. Whereas the Buddha, he had a grand vision from the very beginning. So when he gave these teachings 2,500 years ago, he was not just teaching the people in front of him. He had this enormous idea of his back of his mind. Yeah, he was seeing people at the Ridges Hotel in 2,500 years. Yeah, sitting together, listening to these teachings, not literally, but almost like that. Yeah, and so this is why the suttas are so powerful, because the Buddha actually had the ability to phrase them in such a way that it would be applicable to all people at all times in any kind of culture. Yeah? And of course, the reason for that is because the human condition is basically the same. It doesn't matter where you go in the world. It doesn't matter which culture you're in. It doesn't matter which era you are in. The human condition is the same. We have the same basic yearnings. You want to be free from suffering. We want to find contentment, peace, and happiness in our lives. We want to find a sense of meaning. Yeah, we have the same basic ideas. And the difference in culture is only a very superficial thing. The deep things of the human heart are the same across the board, and these teachings are phrased exactly like that. So make the Buddha your friend. Yeah, this is one of the things that I think we are trying to do by reading these teachings, is that enable everybody to take the Buddha as their real spiritual teacher. One of the things I often ask people, who is your teacher in the world? Yeah. And when you ask people who was a teacher, they always say, this one or that one or this kind of Bhante or this whatever. Very few people say the Buddha is a teacher. Very, very rarely. But actually, that would be a very good answer to say that. Of course, it is not sufficient. Yeah, that's why you're here. That's why we talk a lot. Otherwise, we could just read the suttas. I mean, that's not really good enough either. But these are really the root thing that we come back to. And that is why I think it is one of the purposes of being a monk, one of the things that we should do, one of the duties of being a Buddhist monastic, is to teach the suttas, teach the word of the Buddha, because we live. Yeah, why can't we just walk around the street here in Parramatta and people give us heaps of food? It's such a beautiful thing. Yeah, such a marvel. I've been walking with Bhante Sujata and Venerable Kaliko these last couple of days, and we just walk down the streets, and there's people coming out, yeah, and offering you food. People traveling from far away, all those other shops and the restaurants in the area, and just give you food. Why is that happening? And the reason why it is happening, in part, is because we are Buddhist monks. It's because of the Buddha. It's the inheritance that we have from the Buddha. And so part of our duties in return for that is to make sure that we teach his teachings in the right way. Otherwise, we are almost like frauds. It's not about kind of giving our perspective on the world. It's to present the teachings of the Buddha in the right way. Otherwise, we're not living up to the idea of being the sons and the daughters of the Buddha, depending on who you are. So this is kind of what this is about, yeah? And then, of course, there's a bit of commentary on top of that, because it has to be, otherwise it wouldn't really work. Yeah? So associating with good persons, associating with the Buddha, associating with those who teach in accordance with the Buddha's teachings, yeah? This is what this really is about, associating with good people. It also means having kalyanamittas. It also means hanging out with the people, yeah, who are good Buddhists. It also means that, but primarily, it means associating with those who have a full understanding of these teachings. And then what happens? What happens then? Yeah, then it goes through a series of, I see little dots there, goes through a series of steps, hearing the good Dhamma, getting faith, having the wise attention, etc., etc., leading up to the three kinds of good conduct. Yeah? Three kinds of good conduct, again, body, speech, and mind. And again, we can understand how we do that. What comes after that? So this is actually very interesting. What comes after the three kinds of good conduct? Yeah. four kinds of mindfulness meditation here. Yeah. So, and what is interesting about this, you will notice what is the cause here, what is the condition for being able to meditate properly. The cause and the condition is morality. Yeah? And that idea of morality or kindness being the cause of meditation is one of the things that you see throughout the suttas. It is one of these recurring ideas you see in various guises expressed in different ways. And the more you read the suttas and the more open you are to seeing these ideas, you will see them expressed again and again in the suttas. It's a very, very powerful thing, because very often what you will hear is that the cause for mindfulness meditation, yeah, which includes mindfulness of breathing, is to be mindful in daily life. But actually there's nothing about that in the suttas about being mindful in daily life, being the cause of mindfulness meditation. The cause of mindfulness is always sila, it is always conduct. So if your meditation isn't going very well, the question that you should need to ask yourself is, can I improve my conduct? Yeah? And I don't mean to say that, you know, you are a bad person if your meditation isn't going well. That's not what I mean at all. My point is just that for meditation to go well takes a very, very high degree of purity. We see here the three kinds of good conduct. Good conduct by body, speech, but also by mind. Yeah, is also part of this. So the kindness coming out of our mental conduct, in other words, having a sense of metta, of kindness to the world, having a sense of compassion for other people, having a sense of understanding, all of these things are required for meditation really to take off. Anyway, this is a large topic, yeah, but it's very, very interesting. I should probably talk about this, because this is actually interesting. And then when you do that...
For a change.
And when you fulfill... No. Everything is interesting, isn't it? That's the problem. The course is too short, that's what I'm saying. So, the idea here, yeah, is the idea is, of course, to tie these things together, yeah, so you know why your meditation works and why it doesn't work, yeah? And so this kind of gives you the foundation for understanding. This is actually a very important understanding right there for meditation working and not working. So anyway, let's say that your meditation is working. Mindfulness meditation, what does it mean? It means mostly mindfulness of breathing. That is how it is defined in the suttas. The Pali behind this is satipatthana, but the fulfillment of the satipatthana in the suttas is always the anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing. That's how it is fulfilled, according to the sutta. So I take that to be the main meaning of satipatthana in the suttas. So you watch the breath. What happens when you watch the breath? This is what happens. You develop the seven factors of awakening. These are the opposites of the five hindrances we saw before. Yeah, this is kind of they are almost in contrast with each other in the suttas. And these seven awakening factors, they are factors that start off with mindfulness, because we have just seen the mindfulness meditations. And then they develop from that mindfulness meditation, and going through a series of steps. The steps are just in brief, dhammavicaya, which is the... investigation of dhammas, which Bandhusudhodana translates as principles. It could also maybe be translated as qualities, investigation of qualities. It is about understanding the good and bad qualities of the mind. And as you do that, energy arises, the virya sambhujanga, the energy of the mind, the kind of that feeling of being energetic inside. From that comes the piti being the joy that arises, comes with, at this point, it's actually very profound joy already. From that joy comes the, as you develop the meditation further, comes the pasadi, the deep sense of tranquility, where you become incredibly peaceful and you don't really want to move, do anything else in the whole world. And because you don't want to do anything else in the whole world, samadhi, the immersion. Is it immersion or is it something else? I forget now. Immersion or stillness or something like that. I'm just being a bit naughty. I hope you don't mind. Immersion, right? Samadhi, this beautiful Indian word, which we don't really have anything suitable in English. That's why it's so hard to translate, and we choose different translations. Samadhi, the stillness, the peace of the mind, when you kind of just become a rock, you become completely immersed in yourself, and when the hindrances are completely abandoned. And this is really the kind of prerequisites for awakening, yeah? And then from that, even deeper, you get the upeka sambhujanga, which is the awakening factor of equanimity or evenness of mind, where the mind is completely cool. Yeah, upeka literally means to look on, and it gives you the ability to look on the world without any kind of distortion of the mind, and then being able, and that's why, because you have no distortion of the mind, that is when you start to see things according to reality. And what happens then? This is what happens then. Knowledge, vidya, which is the opposite of avidya, yeah? So this is how this works out, the liberation and vidya, knowledge and liberation. Yeah? So at that point, you have overturned the first factor of dependent origination. You have vidya rather than avidya. So this is how it works. And now you can start to see the idea here, the causality behind avidya, why there is avidya, and how we overturn it, how we give rise to vidya and understanding instead. It starts simply by hanging out with the Buddha, hanging out with the Saparisas, the superior people, the noble ones, the Aryas in the world. As you hang out with those Aryas, you hear the Dhamma, faith arises. When faith arises, you have Yonisamanasikara. Yonisamanasikara gives rise to Satisampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension, or however you want to pronounce it. That leads to sense restraint, the Indriya Sangvara, which leads to the three kinds of good conduct, which leads to the Satipatthanas, the mindfulness meditation, which leads to the seven Bhujangas, the seven factors of awakening, which then leads to knowledge and liberation, Vidya Vimutti. I think that's roughly right. I hope I got that sequence right. I think it's fairly close because I know the sutta reasonably well there. That is how it arises. Now, one of the great things about this, this is one of my favorite little similes. It was the simile that Venerable Kaliko was talking about before. Yeah, the simile which is used here is the simile of the rain on the mountaintop. Yeah, so if it rains on the mountaintop, yeah, if it keeps on raining on the mountaintop, gradually that rain will form into little streams. Yeah, that's what happens when it rains a lot. If it keeps on raining, eventually the rain goes into little streams. If you keep on hanging out with the Buddha, if you keep on hanging out with the Saparisas and the Aryas in the world, the noble ones, yeah, keep that rain coming. That's what it means, hanging out with the noble ones. Keep the rain coming. Then gradually all these factors start to come into existence. Those little streams, as they flow down the mountainside, they become larger and larger. If the rain keeps coming, they become larger and larger. Eventually, those streams, they go into the little lakes. If the rain keeps coming, the rain here again is listening to the teachings, coming back to the Saparisas, coming back to the Buddha. If the rain keeps coming, eventually those little lakes, they fill up. When the lakes eventually fill up, there comes a point when they overflow. When they overflow into rivers. Those rivers go into larger lakes. And as long as the rain keeps falling on the mountaintop, eventually those large lakes too overflow. When the large lakes overflow, they go into the large rivers of the world. The rivers like the River Ganges. I don't know if you have seen the River Ganges. It's a magnificent sight. Yeah, if you cross it at a place like Patna, it's maybe 2 kilometers wide. This enormous, astonishing river. And even this river fills up. Why? Because it keeps on raining on the mountaintop. And eventually, the Ganges empties out in the Bay of Bengal into the ocean itself. Why is that? Because it keeps on raining on the mountaintop. And in exactly the same way, yeah, if you keep on coming back to the suttas, if you keep on listening to the Buddha, yeah, not once, but again and again and again, reminding yourself of the meaning of life, what really matters in the world, yeah, why you should be kind, so you can actually be kind all the time without even a smidgen of a nanosecond of unkindness, yeah. Keep on being kind, keep on doing the right thing. Why? Because you are reminded through the word of the Buddha of the importance of these things. Then gradually each of these factors fills up, just like the water filling up the ocean. And eventually you reach that knowledge and liberation as a consequence. It's a beautiful idea, yeah? And it's so simple. All you have to do is to come back to the teachings of the Buddha. Isn't that really simple? All you have to do is come here, right? And listen to these teachings, and then you are in business. And it's such a marvelous thing. It may sound like magic, but it's not really magic at all. The reason is because these are the teachings that take us out of the delusion and ignorance. They allow us to see the world in a new way. And that seeing of the world in a new way is a gradual turning around of the mind. You start hearing the teachings. You start to see that they seem reasonable. I want to follow along these teachings. And then gradually, as you hear them again and again, your mind turns more and more and more and more, yeah? And this is kind of why it needs to be that conditioning in the long run to be able to actually move forward on this path in this way. So this is really the answer to the conundrum of how to get awakened, is to listen to these teachings enough, to allow yourself to be inspired by them, that all the conditions that follow, they happen as a matter of course, in the same way as the rain on the mountaintop reaching the ocean eventually. Anyway. It's great, isn't it? I find this so nice myself. I really. Anyway.
That's a really good note to wrap up on.
Already?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Yes, gee.
We're wrapping up.
Okay, yeah. Okay, good.
So thank you so much, Venerable Brahmali, for that. And thank you, everybody, for your attendance today. And it looks like we have reached another finishing point, as we did yesterday. I might just spend a couple of minutes to review over where we have come so far. You have a question? The five hindrances are sensual desire, ill will, doubt, restlessness and remorse. Yeah? And the one that we may be starting to feel right now, sleepiness and tiredness. Okay. Where are we? Oh, yes. Yeah. So yesterday we began with an overview of the dependent origination, overview of the 12 factors. We looked a little bit at the mythological context with the Brahmanical teachings, and we gave some explanation of how the dependent origination fits in with the Four Noble Truths, and how it works in terms of explaining how rebirth happens without a self. We began to look at some of the myths that need busting, and the various myths include such things as why dependent origination does not just apply within one lifetime, why it's not merely equivalent to a process of perception, why dependent origination or rebirth does not require a permanent self, and in fact a permanent self is a non-explanation really of rebirth. We looked at the link between feeling and craving, and whether just being mindful of feelings can help you let go of craving, and whether that's sufficient for ending dependent origination, and we concluded that it was not. We also looked at the fact that dependent origination is a specific topic which is different from the philosophical principle of interconnectedness. And we looked at why it is a little bit misleading to think of it purely just as a circular principle. We then went on to have a look at some of the questions around dependency and conditionality, and understanding some of the basic ideas of how we talk about and how we understand conditionality in that context. And finally, we went on to discuss the first of the properties of dependent origination. So we will go through each of the 12 links, and we look today at ignorance. And discuss that from various aspects about what ignorance is, how we experience it, how it's conditioned, and how it is abandoned. So that's where we have come so far. And from tomorrow, we will, assuming that the world still exists and that we still exist in the world, relatively speaking, then we will continue and we'll look at the next factor of sankhara and choices.